You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news, as well as insight and analysis into all the subjects you're talking about in football. I'm Ian McGarry. With me, as always, is the transfer guru, Duncan Castles. Today we'll be bringing you exclusive news on Manchester United, West Ham United, as well as Juventus and Wolves and much more. I'm delighted to say that we're starting, Duncan, with a question from a young man called Sankul Patak, who lives in Mumbai in India, representing, of course, our multinational listenership, which, of course, we value very much. And Sankul has asked us, how do the transfer gurus get the insight about transfers that are going to happen way before anybody else? Does somebody from the clubs tell you something, you know, as a snitch, he asks, or do they get paid for this? Both of which I think we can answer no to each of those questions. But Sankul, we're very grateful for your question. And Duncan, maybe you should start off with, how these things come about.
Yeah, I just say thanks to Sankul for the question and thanks for being such a loyal follower of the Transfer Window podcast. All the best with your recovery. It's a good question. It's actually a question that we get a lot on Twitter, and we get people asking, how can you get stories from these clubs when you are critical of some of the things these clubs do? Surely no one in a football club would speak to a reporter who says negative things at times about their club. And I think it's just a misunderstanding of the way the world of football works, and the idea that football clubs are a unitary entity where everyone is on the same page and everyone is always cooperating with each other. Actually, they're very complex organizations. As we know, big football clubs these days turn over huge amounts of money. There's massive amounts of money involved in transfers, in success on the field, on player contracts. And essentially, one of the big areas of competition for any footballer and any football professional comes from within his own environment he's working in. So there are tensions and there are conflicts, kind of things we report on the podcast on a regular basis. They also generally have contracts which prevent them from saying publicly what they would want to say on many occasions, and can be held in breach of contract if they say things that damage the club's image. But the message needs to go out, and a good way to put a message out can be to pass it on to a journalist you trust. And that would be one of the sources we use. I mean, myself, I've been doing this for almost 20 years. Ian, you're even longer than that. I can tell you that I have never paid anyone for information in football, for a story, for an interview, ever. Nor have I been paid by anyone for putting information out, other than the people who publish the podcast, publish the articles. So it's about, I think our reporting is about developing relationships, talking to the people involved in the sport, thinking about what might happen, asking questions, and relaying it to you guys through articles and on this podcast.
Wishing you well with regards to your health, and also thanking you for your loyalty to the Transfer Window podcast. my experience is very similar to Duncan's with regards to how we get stories. It's how you build relationships with people inside clubs and agents and in the football community. And then, of course, there is a case to say that sometimes people want news to get out there and therefore they're willing to give information. But at the same time, the most valuable stories are the ones that they don't want people to know. And those are the ones that that come via different sources. So that's how we do it at Sankol. And I'm very pleased to say that over the last few days, our story about Mino Raiola's commission pending on Erling Haaland and for his dad as well has made global news with regards to the amount of money that could be paid, leading Raiola himself to talk about the possibility of that transfer. We also broke the story about David De Gea being offered to European football clubs. And again, that has been brought up this week. And here we are in April. So if you want to know the news before it becomes news, the Transfer Window podcast is a place to be. And thankfully, we're very pleased that you are one of our very loyal and faithful listeners, as well as thousands of others who depend upon us to bring that news to you before it becomes news.
Good that you mentioned the Mino Raiola's conversations with leading football clubs that we talked about on the last podcast, and the indication from his camp that during those conversations over what is likely to be the most expensive transfer of the summer, that no conversations were had about wages, about the cost of the transfer, and more importantly about the commission. That was briefed out from Raiola's camp, but to much mirth, I think, to the people he'd been talking to and to people in football who've watched how he's handled other deals in the past. We'll see what happens with the commission, but it's quite amusing to think that he's going around football clubs talking about expensive transfers and the cost of the transfer and the cost of the salary would not be discussed in those meetings.
I suspect Duncan, knowing what we know about Mino and most agents, to be fair, that those particular issues would have been the first that were addressed in those particular conversations with regards to any potential transfer. Interesting also that Pep Guardiola described Haaland as an amazing player. Look at the statistics, he said, for a 20-year-old in terms of the numbers of goals, etc., etc. I think indicating, even though Guardiola tends not to want to talk about players at other clubs before City start their interest, but clearly with Sergio Aguero leaving this summer, then they must have an interest in Haaland, regardless of his price.
Yeah, look, a couple of things we should say on that. One is congratulations to Mino Raiola that he managed to have a conversation with Barcelona in the morning in Spain. That video footage of him arriving in Barcelona was released to the media very quickly.
Congratulations to Mino Raiola. Seriously.
And then still managed to have a conversation with Real Madrid in the afternoon. As one prominent person in football said to me, after when we were discussing that this week, he said, if I'd been at Real Madrid, I would have called Mino the moment that footage came out and cancelled my meeting with him. It's just such an obvious play and a manipulation. But I think that's a testimony to the quality of product And I think for Raul, it really is a kind of product that he has control of at present, that he can manage to have those two meetings with the two most prominent clubs in Spain and have the first element of the first one televised before he starts the second one. The statistics on Haaland, it was some very interesting reporting on how his goal scoring compares to the other top scorers in Europe this season. And how he does it from so few touches of the ball, less than half as many touches and matches as Cristiano Ronaldo or Kylian Mbappe this season, not even a quarter of Messi's touches on the ball. If you look at the top six scorers in European football, so that's Lewandowski, Ronaldo, Messi, Haaland, Mbappe, and André Silva at Frankfurt, Haaland has the fewest tackles and the fewest interceptions of anyone in those six. He completes the fewest passes, just under 10 passes per game. So he is a very, as we've said, he's a very distinct kind of striker who is almost completely focused on scoring goals and scoring goals himself. And, you know, we'll keep referring to this, but go back to the podcast we did earlier this year where we said that Dortmund are happy to sell him this season. Because their analysis is that the team is poorer with him in it as a whole. And that is one of the reasons why they're struggling to qualify for the Champions League, despite the fact that Haaland is putting these ridiculous numbers up on an individual level. And again, very interesting that Guardiola is talking about him. Interesting that he's high on Manchester City's list. Interesting to see if they do that deal, and you have to say that financially, despite what Guardiola was saying this week, they have the greatest firepower to be able to pay the commission, the salary, and the transfer fee that's going to be involved in doing that deal. Well, if they bring him in, Guardiola can turn them into a rounded player who improves Manchester City. And turns into the type of player we're talking about as that, you know, head-to-head candidate with Kylian Mbappe to be successor to Ronaldo and Messi as the world's number one player.
And interesting also, Duncan, from what you've said and what you reported regarding Borussia Dortmund's attitude towards Haaland. As someone once famously said, there's no I in team, and that's exactly what Haaland seems to believe that there is. I don't know if you saw the footage, everyone who's listening, but when he trained at the Etihad Stadium ahead of the tie against Manchester City, he described the stadium as beautiful and made it quite clear that that might be a new home for him with regards to his next move. And as we reported on the podcast last week, it looks like Mino Raiola has played a blinder using Borussia Dortmund as a staging post for Haaland's next transfer and allowing the payment of commission to both him and his father, Alf Inge Haaland, in terms of the next move that Erling Haaland makes. But Duncan, Manchester United is a very interesting subject at the moment. Jesse Lingard is a player who's been rejected by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, sent out on loan to West Ham United, has proved himself to be something of a scoring sensation, none more so than last weekend. And it seems that though the player is under contract, and of course you will give us the details of that contract, United are prepared to play a waiting game because it's our information that they will wait until Lingard is named or not in England's Euro 2020 squad this summer. And if he is, then they'll wait again so that the possibility of his increase in value gives them an advantage in terms of income, and therefore he will be allowed to leave the club despite his very impressive form at the Olympic Stadium. And that would be the case regardless of who United try to buy. Is this fool's gold, Duncan, in the words of the great Stone Roses song? Or is it the case that Lingard simply isn't good enough for Manchester United?
Well, he's on a sensational run of form, 6 goals and 8 Premier League games for West Ham United during this loan period. That's one of his most productive periods in the entire career. He had a very good spell, I think, in the 2017-18 season. But his total return for that was 8 goals from 33 Premier League games, which is his best ever in his career. Last season, just 1 from 22 under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and very much sent to the periphery of the squad. One of the few players, I think, that we've seen Solskjaer berating from the touchline in an aggressive manner, and saw shifted out of the squad, basically replaced in terms of a transfer with Donny van de Beek coming in. I think for Manchester United, it would be very difficult to reintegrate him into the squad because they are so packed with players in the area of the field that he specialises in. I think his preferred position is playing just behind the forwards. They already have a battle there between Bruno Fernandes, which Fernandes has won, and Paul Pogba, who both prefer that position. Donny van de Beek also prefers that position. So they can afford to let him go. And the form he has at West Ham United is allowing them to take a decent transfer fee for him in the summer. And as you say, if he is picked for England, if he does well, European Championship, the exposure that gets should help them increase the money. He only has one more year left on contract. They've already taken up the option on the last deal he signed with the club. So I think there's a limit to how much money they can get. And I think it's because of COVID, because the clubs they are selling him to are likely to be the ones off the Champions League places. I mean, West Ham United is the tier of club you would expect to be going for Lingard. That's the kind of club that players move to after they have been let go by Manchester United, unless they go to Inter. But Inter struggling themselves for cash at the moment, despite their success.
A little sarcasm in there, Duncan.
In Italy. But I think that tier of clubs is the one that's going to have more problems in this market. I think the biggest clubs are managing to put together enough resource to be able to do one substantial deal in the summer. It seems to be the strategy is to get at least one substantial deal in and then shift around other players. The tier down, I think, are having to wait to see if one of their players get picked up by the biggest clubs to see what kind of money they're going to have to spend. So that makes it more complex to capitalize on the deal. But, you know, what's for sure is the last few months and Lingard's performances for West Ham have substantially increased the realistic income that Manchester United can take from a player who, you know, we hear a lot about Solskjaer's man management and how good he is at improving players. Lingard is not an example of that, has to be said. Lingard has gone in the opposite direction, but
That's been very significant, Duncan, for me, that because I witnessed Lingard on a loan at Brighton, my local club, and many people said, both coaches and people around the club, that he was never going to be an international player. And he kind of fulfilled that destiny for the last 3 years at Manchester United. But now, because he scored some goals, and obviously there was a spectacular goal he scored on Sunday, a solo effort, people are saying, oh, he must be included in Gareth Southgate's squad for the Euros. And I'm kind of sceptical about that, to be honest, because I trust the people who've told me that he's not long-term that kind of player. So it is interesting. And also, he's not that young anymore either. So for a player who had huge potential, is now playing quite well for 3 months, doesn't suggest to me that that will see through the test of time.
Yeah, he'll be 29 in December.
29! See, there you go. I mean, that's...
Which so this is the last time you're going to get a transfer fee for him, and you know, okay, you have the argument about games played, and he hasn't played as many games in his career as others of his age, so he could have longevity because of that. Look, what you're saying reminds me of a conversation I had with Manchester United coaching staff when he was in the middle of that purple spell in the 2017-18 season, and asking them how good a player they thought he was, and whether he could be fundamental to the kind of team they were trying to build to win a Premier League title again and to have a chance of winning the Champions League again. And the answer was, you know, this is probably as good as it gets. He works hard. He's committed. He's got a good attitude. Most of the time he's flexible and he can play in different positions, but probably doesn't have anything beyond this. He's not elite level was kind of the message that was coming from that, and you have to say that what's happened subsequently would back that up. A good player, at times a very good player, but not a top player.
He reminds me, Duncan, of Andros Townsend and Wilfred Zaha in terms of the inconsistency of performance, but the sporadic burst of talent that sometimes comes out and people say, wow, he's amazing. And I just don't get it. I don't see it in Lingard. I don't see it in Townsend. I don't see it in Zaha either.
Look, I think players like that are Zaha obviously decided to not to play for England in the end, but they're handicapped by being English. So whenever they perform at a very high level, even in just one game, if they score a great goal. But if they do that for two or three games, they get a level of attention that they would not get if they were of a different nationality. And they get talked about as a solution for England. And I think it's difficult for those kind of players to control the expectation around their game because they're being told they're better than their performances actually merit. And I think you, in that circumstance, you kind of have to applaud Lingard because he has been sent to the periphery of the squad. When he is in many ways a fit to that cultural reboot that Manchester United's PR story is of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, use domestic players, use academy players from Manchester United, he ticks a lot of boxes for the culture reboot, but actually he's one of the ones who's been most damaged by it in terms of his personal career. Yet he has worked and kept himself in good condition, and he's been given the opportunity at West Ham United and he's taken the opportunity. So I think that is a testimony to the kind of things that the, you know, Manchester United coaching staff were saying about him in 2017-18, that mentally they liked him as a player. And you know, it would be easy for him to sit back and complain about Solskjaer, and then, you know, just and let himself leave, push United to let him go at a cheap price in the summer. But he hasn't done that. He's gone, and when he had the opportunity to play football, he's played football very well.
As fellow Scotsman, I'm sure we are amused by David Moyes' phrase when he said that he was giggling at the idea of West Ham playing Champions League football next season, having moved in to the top four as a result of weekend results. And we applaud him for that. One of the Glasgow School of coaching who have succeeded and performed well. And we do wish him well. as far as the last part of the season is concerned. Duncan, you've dug up an interview with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, though, with regards to what he said maybe 4 years ago and what he's been saying now with regards to Manchester United, which makes for very interesting reading in terms of the current circumstances of United.
Yeah, it's actually Manchester United supporters who have dug up this interview and flagged it up to me. But it was ahead of the FA Cup final in 2016. Solskjaer being asked what he thought about the opportunity to win an FA Cup and talking about how it was important for the players because and he was at Molde at the time, remember, we need to remember how to win again. It's a while ago now, so start lifting trophies will give us the hunger again to get back to winning ways. Then next question from the interviewer was Louis van Gaal has been saying that expectations are too high at Manchester United, that the expectation that they should be competing for the Premier League title was unfair on them. What do you think about that? And his response was, it was a disaster. When I was there, being number two, being number two in the Premier League. So I don't agree. Now we are talking top four. We couldn't end second without the season being a failure. So no, standards at Man United should be high. We should be aiming for trophies. We should be winning the league and even challenging for cups. And then asked again whether it was acceptable to lower the standards because there was more competition in English football than the period in which he had been at the club. And he said, I don't think so. I think if you lower your own standards, you end up 10, 15, 20 years from now ending up with no trophies. So it's back on the horse for me. Now, we've talked previously about what Solskjaer was saying when Manchester United got to second place in 2018, how he was critical of that and saying they're back in the Champions League, but I don't think any of the Man United supporters or ex-players or players are happy with a second place where it should be top spot. And then contrasting it with what he said since he's been manager of the club, almost been there as long as the previous manager now. No trophies yet. In fact, Solskjaer himself is on a run of no trophies in 22 attempts at three different clubs in three different divisions. Last one in 2013. He has Manchester United now on their longest run without a trophy in 31 years. And he has been talking, and he went into this season saying that third place was the target. He recently talked about trophies being an ego thing. The contrast with the way he talked before he was manager in the club and arguing that second place would be a disaster and that you need to win trophies to remember how to win again. It's fascinating how his public position on the performances expected of Manchester United is so radically different when he actually is the man in charge of changing things and deciding which players should play, which players should be brought in, what tactics to use, which substitutions to make in a game, and when he was on the byline talking about other managers doing the job.
It's certainly a contrast, that's for sure. And speaking of which, the Lord Lucan of management may well be about to reappear. And of course, I'm talking about Max Allegri, Duncan, who has disappeared effectively. Thankfully, there are no murder victims involved, but except maybe Juventus's title bid. And you reckon he may about to make a dramatic return?
My information is that Andrea Agnelli is considering bringing him back to the club, and the idea has been floated that he should come in and take over from Andre Pirlo. Pirlo has been a disastrous appointment for Juventus, probably a predictably disastrous appointment, given he had no coaching experience when he was given control of one of the biggest clubs in European football. They're currently fourth in Serie A, 12 points behind Inter, who are going to win the title. They're now in danger of missing out in the Champions League. And in fact, they play Napoli tomorrow night with Napoli on the same points as them. So were they to lose that game, they will be in serious danger. It's not just about Pirlo. They also are very unhappy. There's a story we did in the podcast months ago with sports director Fabio Paratici, who's out of contract at the end of the season and looks very much likely to be replaced. Juventus have already approached potential candidates to take over from him. The turning to Allegri is fascinating because Agnelli did not want to sack Allegri. That was a decision of Paratici and Pavel Nedved, and he actually publicly said that he had handed over and had faith in the sporting department decision to move Allegri out and bring in that case Maurizio Sarri in as the new coach. He retained Allegri as a sign of his trust and relationship with him on contract for a year. So Allegri was paid his full 7.5 million net salary last season. Allegri, as we've told you, has been looking for one of the biggest jobs in European football. He expected to be back in work this season. It's gone on longer than he had hoped for. COVID, which has stopped clubs from sacking coaches, has, I think, limited the opportunities available to him. There's an interest there to see whether Manchester United change. There's definitely an interest, I think even more of an interest, to see if Real Madrid change, and he has a good relationship with Florentino Perez. But I'm told that he has not dismissed the possibility of going back to Juventus. What would be required for him, though, is a degree of control over recruitment at the club that he didn't have previously. So if he goes back there, he wants to have more say over which players are moved out, which players come in. He doesn't want to have to work with people like Paratici. And yeah, I think this is very interesting because we've said in the podcast that Allegri's desperate to get back to work. He's had an offer from Roma to come back this season. He said, no, I won't come during the season, because he's waiting for that big job. He's talked about wanting to coach in other European leagues. Spain is one of those. England is definitely one of those. He spent time in England learning the language in preparation for going to the Premier League. But I think you can only stay out of work for so long when you're a football person and you want to get back in. So the timing is interesting from Agnelli, and what I'm hearing from people close to Allegri is it is possible he will take that job.
Would he consider Inter Milan?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, he was lined up to replace Antonio Conte in the summer. If you remember, Conte infuriated Inter's owners and various people.
Well, that was my point, Duncan, yeah. Because we know that Conte's got a very fractious relationship.
Yes, and Allegri was offered the job in the summer, but they needed Conte to walk away. They couldn't afford to pay Conte off and take on Allegri's wages when they were still paying Spalletti, the previous manager, his redundancy payments after getting rid of him to bring Conte in. Inter is a problematic situation because of their finances, because Suning have been instructed by the Chinese government to move money out of football because they ran up a huge deficit, over 100 million euros in their last financial year, and expecting another huge deficit this year. We know what Antonio Conte is like. He is very demanding. His target is to win the Champions League. He wants to prove himself to be an absolute elite level coach by winning the Champions League at a club. You'd have to say that there is conflict, likely conflict, en route if Inter decide to start selling some of their better players, and Romelu Lukaku is being mentioned as a potential sale in the summer, despite the goals he scored, despite being, I think, almost number one choice for Conte when he came to Inter, the player he identified as being most important to his plan for the club. So it will be interesting again to see what Conte does. If he feels he's achieved what was expected of him and has done as much as he can in taking the Italian title back to Inter and doing it in a comprehensive fashion, and thinks, actually, I can't win the Champions League the way football is at present and with the support I'm going to get, then yeah, that would be a job that would also open up in the summer.
It's an interesting circumstance with regards to what's happening in Serie A. Also the case, Duncan, that there may well be a power shift in terms of what's happening at Wolverhampton Wanderers. And you have some very, very interesting and exclusive news with regards to potential outgoings.
Yeah, it has been a very difficult season for Wolves. I think central to it has been losing Raul Jimenez early in the season. If you look at the returns of the team, their leading scorers in the Premier League are Pedro Neto and Ruben Neves, your holding midfielder with 5 goals each. And then you have Raul Jimenez with 4, despite only having 10 appearances before he suffered that fractured skull. They've dropped down to 14th in the Premier League after this weekend's results, 35 points from 30 games. They need to change their squad. And the information I'm getting is that the financial backing from Fosun is not as strong as it's been in previous summers. I don't think that is disconnected with what is happening in China, where as we've talked about, Suning, the Chinese government telling Suning to withdraw money from football, and they've done it with other major industries who have invested in football at the behest of the Chinese government. There is now a discouragement from spending money on football. I'm not hearing that Fosun are going to step away from Wolves, but I'm hearing that they have to generate their own cash this summer. We told you a few weeks ago that Pedro Neto was being made available for sale at a substantial price, and that they felt they could get a good transfer fee for him because there had been interest, importantly, I think, from Juventus last summer, and a strong offer from Juventus last summer, but one that was dependent on performance on the field. I'm hearing it's not just Pedro Neto that's being made available for sale. It's also Ruben Neves and also Adama Traore. So essentially the three, I think you would say, most sellable, most valuable talents on the Wolves squad at present, excluding Raul Jimenez, because it's obviously going to be difficult to sell Jimenez until he's come back and started playing again. And Jimenez is now pushing towards 30, which again makes the value of a transfer more difficult to secure. You know, Adama Traore is 25, he's contracted until 2023. Ruben Neves, 24, contracted until 2023. Pedro Neto, an even stronger position, and he's 21, now a full Portugal international and contracted until 2025. They want to sell at least one of those for a substantial fee, perhaps more than one of those, and then reinvest and freshen up the squad. They're particularly focused on looking for wingers and a striker, also possibly to bring a midfielder in. They're going to have to generate that cash from their own squad rather than look, I'm told, to Fosun to provide more cash to buy players. And they're doing it, as we keep saying, in a far more difficult environment to sell than this project was designed in, and where this project has been so successful up until this season in terms of picking up those excellent young talents from around European football, a lot of them from Portugal, putting them in the Premier League spotlight, seeing their value increase, and having them well coached by Nuno Espirito Santo. I think it's also been a difficult season for Nuno. And that may also be a complication for Wolves.
in the eyes of the Wolves fans, does this approach to selling out kill the Wolves' dream? Because it has been an incredible 3 years for the club with regards to results and the way they've been playing football. It's going to be hard to rebuild Duncan with regards to replacing players, because obviously Diogo Jota obviously left for Liverpool as well. And it just seems that they might be returning, or it looks like they might be returning to a kind of small town image of their club, rather than being, you know, aspiring to be one of the biggest clubs in England, if not Europe, given the signings they've made and the progress they've made as well.
Well, look, they've been very good in the market in the past, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be good in the market going forward. They haven't lost that ability to select the right talents to bring into the club who can increase in value. I think it's more about generating some capital to be able to sign some of those players. And I would imagine they're thinking, well, we know that the clubs we usually buy from are struggling with COVID as well. So if we can get money for Neto, Traore or Neves, then we can buy at a cheaper price the targets we want to come in and allow them to develop. I think with Traore and Neves, you've also got to be aware that they have been talked about as moving out of this club for some time now. Ruben Neves was a target for Manchester City. There was a point at which Wolves were valuing him at 100 million euros. Adama Traore just last season was valued by Wolves at one point, or by Fosun, at 150 million euros. So these players have gone through a period in which they are being talked about as moving to bigger clubs and moving to Champions League clubs. So in a sense, if you are going to sell, pick the players who've got the high valuations and the ones who mentally are in a place where they feel it's time to move on in their career. Wolves have this season had discussions with Traore about a new contract, but from what I understand, the numbers they're offering him are way below what he would expect to receive given his status he achieved in the game last season. He's not on a particularly rich contract at present. So I don't think it's the end of the dream for Wolves. And I think they still retain a lot of the qualities that have got them into this position. And if they can use the market well for themselves again, there's no reason why they can't build a squad that can be highly competitive in the Premier League again.
I suspect, Duncan, we will see quite a lot of transfer action at Wolves in the summer, certainly if they manage to sell some of those players. This is the first Transfer Window podcast of the week, which of course means it's time for Hero and Villain. And I'm very pleased to say, as I mentioned before, Brighton being my local team, that Duncan has selected I'm not sure if he has or not. Mike Dean did not give a penalty for Brighton against Manchester United, but I suspect he's going to disappoint me and give us someone else.
Well, look, Mike Dean and the video assistant referee in that game have to be a very strong candidate for Villain of the Week, given that it was a clear penalty offence. Harry Maguire, not challenging for the ball, takes Danny Welbeck out a few yards from goal just as he's going to shoot. It's, you know, one of the best chances you can have to score in a game. It's 1-1, that goes in, it's 2-1. The decision that they should have been making there was whether it was a denial of a clear goal-scoring opportunity and conceding a penalty without challenging properly for the ball, therefore penalty and red card to Harry Maguire. Instead, Dean, I think, look, there's a degree of excuse because he only gets one view at it and he's looking at it from behind. So he's the one who has the bigger get out in that he might not have seen it properly. But the VAR did see it properly, and at the very least, under the protocol that the Premier League's been working on at present, that should be referred to Dean to have a look at the screen, to give himself time to think, to look at the other angles and decide whether he'd made a mistake. Instead, he doesn't. Brighton lose to Manchester United for the second time this season because of VAR decisions. Remember famously that Manchester United won a game in which Brighton hit the woodwork a record number of times.
Five times.
Outplayed Manchester United in that game, much as they outplayed Manchester United for a good period of the first half at Old Trafford at the weekend. Yet have a penalty given against them after the final whistle goes. So that's, you know, that's 4 points from VAR decisions switching from Brighton to Manchester United just in one season. But villain of the week, I am going to go for Jose Mourinho.
What?
For his...
excuse me while I check if hell is frozen over.
For his his comment when he was asked about, I think quite cleverly, by a BBC journalist, that your team used to specialise in closing out one goal leads in games. What's gone wrong with Tottenham? And his response was, same coach, different players. Now, factually, he's correct. And there is a clear problem with Tottenham's defence. And they make a huge number of unforced individual errors that have been costing Tottenham points all season. But I don't think he does himself any favours with that comment. If it was another manager, it wouldn't be picked on to the same level. We see articles from very prominent people in football talking about how Mourinho could learn a lesson in man management from basically every other manager and the coach, and holding Luke Shaw out as an example, quite ironic given what we've been saying about Jesse Lingard earlier in this podcast. When Mourinho says these things, it gets picked up on in a way it doesn't with any other manager. It gives his players, some of whom he has stretched to the limit, that's his coaching style, is to push his players, but it gives them, those ones that are unhappy with them, the opportunity to grumble. It puts extra pressure on him, puts extra pressure on the club, puts pressure on Daniel Levy to change the manager at the end of the season, with a lot of the supporters calling for that. Mourinho is aware that his position at the club is in jeopardy. He's doing everything he can to qualify them for Europe, to win the League Cup, to get the best finish possible. He doesn't want to leave the club. And, you know, we saw how he talked about his sabbatical time in after being sacked by Manchester United, and how he had to reconsider elements of his management. And I think it's pretty obvious that one of the things he felt he had to reconsider is the way he talked about players in public interviews. He's actually tried to be very controlled in those interviews in a number of difficult scenarios for Tottenham during his period there, but he can't keep it under control throughout the entire time. And then this, you know, one throwaway comment, which is factually accurate, makes it more difficult for him, I think, to get the results he needs. So, villain of the week, Jose Mourinho.
Excuse me while I faint, listeners, but in the interest of the podcast, I will continue. I have two heroes, given that Duncan's given us two villains. My first is Football Club de Valencia for walking off the pitch on Sunday when one of their players, Mukhtar Diakabi, was allegedly racially abused by Cadiz's Juan Calla. And the referee has since confirmed that he received a complaint about that. And I think we all need to support that particular incident with regards to trying to stamp out racism in football. My second, and this will probably go quite well, Duncan, with you, as well as because of your villain of Jose Mourinho, is Sam Allardyce for his 5-2 win at Stamford Bridge with his West Brom side. Incredible. I mean, they played great football. Robinson's goal was one of the best of the season in terms of his volley. Just sensational. And Allardyce's post-match interview, if you didn't see it, look at the off the camera footage about him laughing when he comes in to say, I never thought I'd be standing here telling you that my team had won this game by 5 goals, which, to be fair, is probably quite accurate, Duncan.
Has Tam Tuchel asked for a loan of the Four Granada yet?
I think Big Sam was... I mean, I might be firing the Granada up, actually, to go see him. Yes, it was quite a weekend of Premier League football, which I'm sure you all enjoyed. This has been, of course, the news before it becomes news. We're very grateful to Sanko Patak, our young listener from Mumbai, who pointed that out. And my best wishes go to him as well as Duncan's. And you can catch up with us if you like the podcast. Please share, like, rate and review on all social media platforms. It's at Transfer Podcast on Instagram, on Twitter and Facebook. Please engage with us individually as well if you would like to, with at Duncan Castles on Twitter and at GarboSJ for me. We'll be back with you later this week. Until then, we say stay well, be safe. Thanks for listening.